Oh.
Who fills it? It's
Okay.
kind of been there since I've gotten been.
Are you guys okay if I maybe share a QR code for SPR Junior Section for a couple minutes while people are trickling in? Welcome everybody who already in the room. We are super excited for this webinar as we wait for people to trickle in. Just wanted to share the QR code to sign up for Society for Pediatric Research Junior Section, who is sort of one of the two sponsors for today's webinar. And so if you're at all interested in kind of continuing with sort of additional resources from the Society for Pediatric Research, this would be a great thing to sign up for. We'll maybe give people another 2 more minutes to kind of trickle in. It looks like we have a good quorum. Well, welcome everybody. So I'm Jing Sheng. I am a neonatology fellow at UCSF and also Society for Pediatric Research Junior Section President. And so I've been really excited to think about initiatives to help trainees who are interested in becoming pediatric investigators and try to think about kind of the nuts and bolts. And so that's kind of how this webinar series idea came about is, we identified this need and wanted to, be able to bring something that basically could be applicable to sort of trainees across the country who are interested in pediatrics and doing research. And so Society of Pediatric Research, obviously, has been a great support for trainees who are interested in research, and as is the Association for Medical School Pediatric Department Chairs, which has been interest also instrumental in helping us put together this webinar series. So before we start with our panelists, I just wanted to also introduce our co-sponsor, and we have Dr. Lisa Satlin, who is professor and chair of pediatrics at Mount Sinai, to kind of say a quick word on behalf of AMSDEC.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jing Sheng. So welcome to everybody who's joining us today. You know, I'm really thrilled that we are launching this partnership with SPR focused on this webinar series. AMSPDEC, for those of you who may not know, is the Association of North America that includes all the department chairs. And within AMSPDEC, I chair the research committee. A strategic priority of our research committee is to foster career development of pediatric physician scientists and investigators. So we had started a different type of a webinar a few years ago, focused on different groups of potential constituents. But again, we are really delighted that SPR is now partnering with us, and I look forward to hearing today's webinar. Thanks so much for joining. And if I could remind everybody to mute your Zoom rooms until you have a question. If you do have a question, please raise your hand and or just indicate your that you have a question in the chat room. Thanks.
Yeah, I definitely second that. We definitely want this experience to be super interactive. And so kind of the format that we thought we would at least start out with is with some introductions from our panelists, and then a couple questions to kind of get things started. But anytime that you have a question, please, again, raise your hand. I'll be monitoring the chat. And then basically, you know, I'm hopeful that by the second half of this webinar that we'll actually be able to sort of have a flow of conversation. With that, I would like to introduce our panelists. So just because people are kind of showing up on the screen sort of in this order, could we just start with Dr. James? Could you just kind of introduce yourself, you know, your specialty, your institution, your faculty rank, and kind of, you know, just sort of a little one-word sentence about what you do for research?
Certainly. Hey, my name is Scott James. I'm thrilled to be with you all today. I'm pediatric infectious diseases. I'm at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, or UAB, in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm an associate professor. I guess my main role here, I have a basic science, basic translational virology lab, where I do a lot of antiviral work, screening, drug resistance, things of that nature. And I'm also sort of the central laboratory component for sort of a multi-center clinical trial network that I get to be a part of as well. So I kind of do go bench to clinical in terms of the research spectrum, and yeah, just have a blast doing it. I'm also the fellowship program director here, and so have a really strong passion about sort of trying to recruit and raise up the next generation of PEDS ID physician scientists.
Dr. Baker-Smith.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for the invitation to present today. My name is Dr. Carissa Marie Baker-Smith. I'm a pediatric cardiologist. I currently work at Nemours Children's Health in Wilmington, Delaware. And I am associate professor, and also I co-direct our research program, as well as direct our prevention program, and a sort of interim director for our heart failure transplant program. My work, I use big data to model the relationship between non-traditional risk factors and cardiovascular disease risk factor development in children. It's a mouthful. And we do have some implementation science projects that we're leading and are funded. So happy to talk about that.
Dr. Hooven?
Hello, I'm Tom Hooven. I'm an assistant professor. I'm calling from University of Pittsburgh, Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, and I'm a neonatologist here. I run a lab that studies bacterial interactions and infections in the perinatal period. We focus mostly on group B strep. My research background is in bacterial genetics and regulation of bacterial virulence. which I apply to models that are relevant to my clinical population. And then I'm also involved in some clinical research and some translational research in our division that touches on those issues. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And Dr. Alvira?
Great, thank you. I'm Christine Alvira. I'm an associate professor, critical care medicine here at Stanford University. I'm a basic scientist. We're very interested in the lung and what makes the lung, the immature lung, unique in terms of sensitivity for injury and capacity for repair. And we do a lot of work really looking at the pulmonary endothelium, single cell transcriptomics, and genetic mouse models. I'm the president of SPR. So I work with Jingxing a lot, very closely. And I also direct at the departmental level a program that we have here at Stanford called the Physician Scientist Bridge to K program, which is a program that really tries to help our sort of pre-K instructors really navigate that transition from fellowship to first faculty job. And that's a program that I'm very invested in and really enjoy leading. So happy to talk about all of those issues today.
Thank you so much. So my first question is just to kind of get everybody starting to think about sort of how to put together research ideas with their career is, if, you know, the four of you could think about sort of back to your residency and fellowship days, did you know what you wanted to do career-wise, you know, in terms of research? Was this kind of the research path, or was this the career path that you thought you would be on? Just to kind of give us a little bit of perspective on your journey, I guess. Dr. Alvira, maybe we can start with you. We'll just sort of go in reverse order.
Happy to. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I actually, looking back, if I look back from where I am now to, let's say, when I was a resident, I always liked science, but I actually wasn't someone who realized that I would enjoy a path as a physician scientist until fellowship, which is pretty late, I think, actually, to enter basic research. And at the time, I think I was just struck by in the ICU, how much we didn't know, and actually still don't know. There was so much complex physiology and really like pathobiology, and most of our therapies were supportive. And I was really interested in acute lung injury. And I think honestly, the thing, and I've said this, I think in other presentations, the key for me was actually interacting early in my fellowship with some physician scientists at the bedside who engaged in discussions at a level that made me just really inspired to try and answer big questions. And I thought, well, I've never worked in a lab before. Let me try it. I think I was super naive. And we can talk, you know, later about, you know, that journey. But so that was how it was for me. I came in with a very open mind, and I try and encourage our fellows who are like stem cells undifferentiated to kind of keep an open mind, because you may not know, some experience may present itself and you would never think you would want to do it. And then you are drawn into a path that you never thought you would take.
How about you, Dr. Hooven?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with everything that Christina said. I did not anticipate my own path either. And I got into doing the kind of research that I do now as a resident. I think my scientific journey in my career really started the way a lot do, through meeting my mentor, who's name is Adam Ratner, and he was a pediatric infectious disease. He still is a peds infectious disease doctor. He's at NYU now. And, you know, he invited me into his lab and let me kind of tinker around. And I got hooked on doing bacterial pathogenesis research. I was already pretty well committed to doing neonatology. So I think for me, the question was like, how was I going to merge those things? His lab had an interest in perinatal infections, and GBS ended up being a fit for that. You know, I would say that if I could talk to myself way back then, one message that I would give myself is like, this is fine. This is a completely reasonable thing to study as a neonatologist. But I kind of realized as I went forward and would present my work to other neonatologists that I felt a little bit like an outlier. You know, there was a lot of sort of basic physiology research in neonatal populations, which makes a lot of sense given the people that I work with. And then I would come in and start talking about bacterial genetics. And people were kind of like, well, what are you talking about? And so I learned over time, and I think I've gotten better at this, to make sure that the two stories are aligned early on. And I think that's been kind of a lesson that I've had to learn to really pitch what I'm doing to the audience and make sure that they understand at a very early level or early stage what the relationship is.
Yeah, I think, I knew I liked science pretty early. I mean, in high school, I would do like these summers, these Saturday science programs. And then as even like later in my training, I did like a master's. And so I was a math major in undergrad. And then when I got to medical school, I did a master's in cell and molecular between my second and third year, because I had this interest and fascination with angiogenesis. And so that's when I got introduced to sort of mouse models, but realized I think some of this was finding and aligning my strengths and passions and interests. And so some of this was the desire to secure certain skill sets, like really understand at the cell and molecular level what was happening. But then looking back on it, I think that really what happened for me is, as a fellow, the opportunity arose to be on this T32 during my first year. And that really, I wasn't anticipating that to happen. And so I really had to think creatively about what were my interests, what contribution was I trying to make, and where did my strengths align with the contribution that I wanted to make in the scientific arena. And having that strong math background and really enjoying like big data, I'm looking back on it now, I think, gosh, this is before anybody really talked that broadly about AI and things like that. But and before we had these huge, or at least readily available, huge data sets. But I really tried to combine my interest in math, which ended up being statistics, with analyzing data. And then in that was basically developing these skill sets. And so what happened is it kind of came together like these little pieces. Like there was the interest in one area, the sort of North Star in terms of the difference that I wanted to make, and then bringing in my own strengths, which really kind of helped me to align the direction of my research career. And it wasn't by any means traditional. I think one of your questions was, if I had to look, I think the traditional clinician science path that people think about is, K to R sort of transition. And that wasn't the path for me. And I think for lots of reasons that actually worked to my advantage. And in some ways, maybe there were some disadvantages in terms of time to getting to like this stage of funding. But I would say aligning your interests with your strengths, and that difference that you really want to make. And just like some of the other speakers, panelists said, I think that sometimes your clinical experiences feed the direction of your research career as well.
My story is, I was late to the bench research game for sure. I, in residency, did not have any substantial research experience. My draw to pediatric infectious diseases was because of a clinical love, some global experiences that sort of fed into just a love for PEDS ID. So I went into fellowship. I came to an institution that had a very strong research footprint because I knew that I wanted to at least have opportunities to grow in those areas. I had the very naive thought that if I don't try bench research now, I never will. And so I had some clinical questions that drove me to bench research experiments that could help answer those questions. And so I did not come in with a preset notion of what exactly I wanted to study, but I ended up finding I had essentially kind of a convergence of my giftings, my passions, a mentor that I really, really clicked with and that was ready and willing to invest in me, and then just sort of a clinical direction that would, feed my basic science pathway. Because I'm an MD, I'm not a PhD. I kind of want to make sure everything, even when I'm at the bench pipetting and doing cell layers and all that. I've got the patient in mind, as cliche as that sounds, that I'm a bench researcher because I like taking care of patients and they feed each other in terms of inspiration. If you'd asked me in residency, I would not have predicted that I'm where I'm at, but found what I consider to be a pretty fertile area and then planted myself and have grown and have enjoyed it ever since.
Yeah, thank you for those stories. It's actually really reassuring to hear that you don't have to have, you know, the 10-year, 20-year career plan mapped out in fellowship and residency. I think I know, at least I'm also just sort of feel very intimidated with launching a basic science career or, you know, a clinical research career at this stage of training. So, it's, you know, it's good to know that you don't have to have it sort of all together. So just kind of segueing from that point that, you know, all four of you actually did make was, how did you get your start? Like, how did you come up with a research idea? Or if you didn't have a research idea, sort of how did you get kind of funneled into it? I know some of you kind of alluded to it, but if you could maybe go to that a little bit more specifically, sort of, again, just kind of keeping in mind the nuts and bolts, if you could pass on some of those pieces of advice. So.
Yeah, I think the research question, and you'll have different research questions at different times in your career. I think personally, they've been driven by, I don't know, there's this great analogy of there's people in this water and there's people at the shore trying to pull them out of the water, but there's somebody standing at the shore thinking, why are these people falling into the water? You know, researchers, we go past the immediate to understand what's happening upstream. And I think if you're driven by that, that's kind of where the questions come in, and that's where you sort of formulate your hypotheses and start designing the approach. I think the biggest pitfall, and I know this is a little different than the question that you asked, but the biggest pitfall I think is scope of the question, right? So I think it's not, people will chuckle at this, but you know, everybody goes and we're gonna save the world, kind of big picture aims are way too big, too broad, and trying to learn the skill of, yes, you have a question, but how do you ask the question in a way that is feasible and that can be done and novel and innovative and significant? And so those are things you learn from a mentor, I think, and through trial and error as well. But I think it starts with that clinical experience. For me, and for many people that I've talked to, it starts with that clinical experience.
I completely agree. I also think when you're just starting out, sometimes it's really hard to come up with a specific question yourself. And I'm not necessarily sure, like I still struggle now, like writing grants, like, is this a significant question? Is the scope small enough where it's feasible? So sometimes I think, especially if I've noticed with trainees who are really intellectually curious, they're like, I could study so many things. I have so many questions. So sometimes it's helpful to even identify sort of what discipline are you excited about? And this is where it goes back to the passion, I think, like Dr. Baker Smith's passion for math, right? What kind of data do you like working with? Are there specific methodologies that you're super excited about? Is there an organ system that you love? And then talking to potential mentors and having the mentor really help you define a question that's appropriate for your stage of training, at least at the initial stage, I think is helpful. Now, that being said, you have to still bring your own passion and your interest, because I actually ended up, for various reasons, I think I'm kind of a people pleaser early in my career, agreeing to take on a project that actually I hated. And I did that project for like 5 years. I actually got a career development award based on the project. I was like, this is the project that will like never end. In the end, I think I persevered. I came out on the other side. I learned some good skills. It would have been better if I had just been more honest with my mentor and said, I'm really not interested in this specific question. So, you know, don't completely give all ownership to your mentor, but I think recognize that coming up with a question that's important, can be feasible, exciting, is not easy. So if you feel overwhelmed and you struggle with it, that's totally normal also.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on that because I completely agree. It's that the early component of trying to discover or narrow down rather what you want to study, because I think probably all of us go into a situation like that with a ton of different directions of interest. I'm just naturally curious in those different directions. So helping have wise people who have been there before you, who can kind of help you consider all these different options and help you hone in on where your passions are best directed. So kind of taking some feedback in that sense. So very early in my process, I actually just literally made appointments with sort of like every research faculty person that I could find that was remotely related to the types of things that I was in, even if they were doing projects that I didn't think I was interested in. And I just went and had, I don't know, like, you know, 30-minute meetings with them and just talked and learned about what they were doing. And we talked about opportunities. I asked them questions. I just learned about kind of their workflow and kind of, you know, it was like meet and greet for a first year fellow, but it was also me kind of seeing the scope and range of types of research projects that were out there. I learned a ton doing it. There were definitely people I talked with where I either walked away going, I'm not interested in researching what they're interested in, or perhaps I don't think I could work closely with them. Not in a, like just as a mentor mentee click, like you've got to find someone that you can track with. And so it was really, really formative for me, helped me hone in and then have some follow-up meetings and some, you know, consider kind of next level questions and eventually led to a really good mentorship match and a project that was partially my project because I was asking the questions, but it was kind of, he had already been thinking about that stuff because he was light years ahead of me. And then it just sort of, I don't know, naturally merged and ended up being just a great entry project for me to figure out if bench research was what I liked. And sure enough, I think thanks to that process and that mentor's help and investment, it was a really supportive environment and I loved it.
I see a question in the chat, which I'll sort of steer my answer toward that because I think it's related. It says, how did you balance your time as a junior faculty to establish your clinical practice and your research? Related, is there anything you wish you had known when looking for your first faculty position? And so just to sort of say something about the first part about balancing your time early in your career, I think, and I often say to residents and fellows who are looking to start a research career and who don't have a PhD or haven't spent time in a graduate program doing research, which was my situation as well. I was an MD. I'd gone to medical school. That I think one way or another, you have got to carve out devoted, protected time to do this. To undertake that project and to develop research skills, research portfolio, the ability to communicate with other researchers in your field. I just think if there was an era when it was possible to kind of seamlessly move from the clinic or from the unit into the lab and kind of merge the two during the course of the day, that time has passed. The questions and the technologies are too intricate and too sophisticated to kind of just like weave it in, I think. I mean, there may be just super geniuses here who can do that, but I certainly couldn't. And so a choice I made when I was really committing to this path was my research training happened through the National PSDP program, the Pediatric Scientist Development Program, which I see various heads nodding, and I see some names here of people who I know are in that program. But I, if you don't know about it, I would direct you to it. The PSDP is a way for pediatric subspecialty fellows to get protected time and funding to do bench clinical or translational research for 2 or 3 years. And I couldn't be where I am now without that time. It just wouldn't have happened. So there's other ways to do it. I mean, I don't think that that's a one path fits all, but I would say to the people who have not really started doing devoted time to research, think about like, how can I do that? Because it just, for me, and I think for everybody, to answer the questions that you have, you know, you come in with questions. I had a postdoc who I worked with who would say, questions are cheap, like easy to just toss out great clinical questions, things we don't understand about biology, like we can do it all day. What you really need to do, and other people have said this too, is get a sense of how you can match the approaches that exist to those questions and kind of find that spot where it's, you're at the edge of what's known and it's innovative, but it's not an insane idea. And that just really takes time and experience, and you need to carve out those opportunities.
Yeah, so thank you. Those are really helpful thoughts and comments. It sounds like mentorship is really key. Having somebody who can kind of help you, guide you, and sort of help narrow down or develop questions is really key. And then just also just identifying opportunities to find the time to do research is also key.
And Jane, can I add something? Just
of course,
the line of mentorship. So and I'm sure some people know this, but when we say mentor, there's usually a plural to that. So it's typically you have a mentoring committee or group, and mentoring is it can be challenging, as Scott alluded to, like finding, not every relationship fits, right? So it can be challenging finding the right primary mentor, but you can have people that mentor you in different ways. So somebody may be your mentor for your clinical path. Somebody may be your mentor for an aspect of your research. Somebody may be a mentor for your writing, right? They may be as somebody who's a mentor for, I don't know, your presentation. It can vary. And also I found one thing that was helpful as a fellow. I had one mentor who was very hands-on. So sort of 9 p.m., the email stream just started wide open. So that's when everybody's clinical day was surely over. Well, it's your own call. And then there was this back and forth. And then I had another mentor at the time who was like, show me the final product and I will like look at it from there. So I think you have to understand too, that people work differently. Some people, you know, a little bit more hands-on, some people not as hands-on. But there's usually like a mentoring group, and the mentors aren't confined to your institution. So I would put this bit out as well, that think about your organizations, your national organizations. One thing that was very helpful for me as I was identifying mentors and sponsors is like the American Heart Association and other organizations where you meet and interact with people from other institutions. And that can be very helpful. I mean, still very helpful. So, you know, they know of opportunities and research projects and can serve as, you know, co-investigators or collaborators on your projects as well.
Hi, everyone. I have a question. This is Marisu. I'm also I'm one of the former presidents of SBR and working with Jingxin. Thank you so much for being here and sharing all this knowledge with us. I think something that we encounter frequently in research is I feel like it's for every victory, there's probably 5-10 things that have failed before that. So can you guys just tell us a little bit about a memorable thing that just didn't go your way? Maybe a grant that wasn't funded, experiment failure, and how you navigated around it.
I mean, I'll just say, I know I just said I have to say this, like you have to be persistent. It's nice when it like aligns, the stars align, you come out of fellowship, you're a junior faculty, you get your first K, you like go on, you get your R, like that's beautiful, but that doesn't happen for everybody. And that's okay. I think I struggle with that a lot. Most of my funding now is internal, but it still allows me to do the work that I want to do. So persistence is key, but I'll let other people comment too.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the grant part, you just have to just know that not getting grants is part of the process. Like, I don't even consider that a failure, honestly. That's just part of it. But I will tell you that I think sometimes these things that you might feel like are failures or obstacles, when years down the road, you'll realize actually that they were just turning points in your career. So for me, I entered a lab of great physician scientist neonatologist. I actually almost did neonatology. I was so close to being a neonatologist. And so I entered her lab, even though I decided to do pediatric critical care fellowship,
studying kind of this maturational differences in lung injury, and like nothing worked. Like literally there was, I was trying to learn one assay and I literally would go into the dark room every day and pull out like a blank film every experiment because I could not get this experiment to work. And it's sort of like surprising because like, why I didn't just quit? I don't think I knew I could quit, honestly, because, you know, then I go into the unit and I felt like pretty competent. I mean, it was a steep learning curve, but I felt like I was gaining proficiency. And then I go to the lab and I get my ice bucket and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Nothing works. And then I eventually got the project to work. I still remember that like first result. And it showed like something really cool that was different between the neos and the adults. And I was like super excited and like jazzed. I'm like, okay, I love science. Science is amazing. And maybe 2 months after that, I found out that my PI was recruited to another institution. So she was shutting down her lab and leaving. And I was like wrecked, right? I was like, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen to me. First year fellow, not knowing what I was going to do. I still thank her so much because she could have just like been like, sorry, this is the way it goes, right? Because this is academia, right? It happens. She was so like, we have to find you another home. I can't abandon you. I feel so bad about this. I mean, it was a great, it was like, she's being recruited to CHOP to be the division chief. So of course she had to do that. And I ended up entering a different lab, a vascular biologist from Toronto SickKids, Marlene Rabinovich. She's like world renowned, right? Totally different environment, actually. Very, very highly structured, very, very intense, big lab, which like scared me. Actually, the first few weeks I was there, I was like, this is horrible. Like, I'm going to die here. But actually, in retrospect, because I had like no background, no training, that kind of rigorous environment was actually so much better for me in the end, because I would come at 9:30 or 10 and there were people in the lab. I wasn't by myself with my ice bucket wandering around. And in the end, I was then able to kind of blend all the like lung inflammation stuff with the vasculogenesis part. And then when I was moving to independence, I was different from both of my mentors. So it was at a time something that I thought was like the worst thing possible. But in retrospect, I would definitely not be here if that whole series of events hadn't happened. So, I mean, it's cliche to say like lemon out of lemonade. It wasn't really like, no, lemonade out of lemons, right? Yeah, I had it backwards. but I do think that all of these things, experiments that don't work, projects that don't work, like it's not, if it's the case that every hypothesis that you create works out, there's something wrong, right? Because that's just not science. So you, again, you have to just recognize this is just part of it. And whatever the results are, it's telling you something interesting. So follow the science. Like, don't pigeonhole yourself into trying to always make it fit your hypothesis, because maybe it's even cooler than you thought, more exciting, more interesting. Or you have some opportunity that you think is like really going to inhibit you, but then it takes you in a different direction. So it's, I know it's like really hard to feel that way in the moment, but just trust in the process, I think, and trust in the fact that there, the uncertainty of science is part of it, right? It never gets better. It's not like we now all put in grants and get them funded every time. And there's a really great clip. If you search it, Google like grants not discussed, Nobel laureate. There's a great YouTube clip about a great investigator who the day she won the Nobel Prize also found out her grants got triaged, and it's like hilarious. So watch that.
I want to add two quick things, and I just also want to address Lillian's second question, which was, is there anything you wish you had known when looking for your first faculty position? And they're going to overlap, so I'll be brief. One is that, and in terms of things to know when looking for your first faculty position, I sort of lucked into this without realizing it. So I was fortunate, but if I were doing it again or looking somewhere else, I would definitely ask. It's, I think, really valuable to find out who is going to be around you, who is at your same stage, in your same milieu, who seems like open and sort of outgoing talking about these things. Because as you're hearing, and as you all know, it's a tough row to hoe. I mean, there's a lot of you have to take a lot of lumps in order to achieve what you're trying to achieve. And if you do it alone or in an environment that's very sort of closed off and you don't have those connections, that is, I think, what really feeds imposter syndrome, which I think you all know what that is. If you don't have people you can talk to and say like, oh, my grant didn't get funded. And, you know, they're like, oh, me too. Three this week, you know, that just really makes all the difference. And I think there are different environments that will do that differently. And if you're around more senior people who are like more successful, it's something to think about. Like, what kind of people are there? Are they going to be constantly pumping their fists because they just got like the big program project grant and you're going to feel like, oh my God, I'm not making it. Or do you have people who are around you who are going to be in the same boat? So that's one thing. The one other thing I wanted to say, which I never would have thought of before I took my job here at Pittsburgh, but I think it's very important related to grants, is take a look at what your institution's pre-award support is. And what I mean by that is the people, not scientific, the administrators who are going to help you put your NIH or other grants together, get them submitted, make sure that you've checked all the boxes, and sort of smooth that process for you. Because the offices that do this are not all created equal, and great universities, you know, super shiny Ivy League universities can have pre-awards offices that are really not good. And you feel like every time you're putting in a grant, it's like the first time they've ever done this and they don't know what to do and it's really stressful. And a really effective office that does that can make a huge difference. And it's something to ask about and actually try to meet those people and ask the people who you're interviewing with about how does that all work? Because it multiplies, right? Like the more grants you put in, if every time you have to do three times more work because that office doesn't know how to do it, it's a huge burden.
I think I would just sort of summarize what everyone is saying with that echoes my experience that pitfalls are the norm. They're the pathway through which we navigate to find what's next. That's sort of where the diversification of our research portfolio comes from, is often pivoting as we follow the science and hit a roadblock and work our way around it. And then you find some new insight during that detour that goes, oh, wait, but that leads me to a different question. And that takes you down another 10 years of research, right? So following those pitfalls is the process by which basic science, translational science, any research, to be honest, happens. And then part of it is just like your attitude. Like Christina, when you were talking, you were outlining the realistic pathway that we all travel, but you were modeling this just sort of positive mindset of the barriers are there. I'm going to view them as a stepping stone rather than a wall. And it really is that sort of perseverance mindset. I totally agree with Tom. Ask for help. Surround yourself with people. Find out about the help that's available to you where you are, and don't be shy about reaching out and finding near peer mentors and administrative support, infrastructure that can kind of help you navigate those pitfalls. And then regardless of all that, be ready for rejection, because it's going to come. Like reviewer two is out there. He or she will find you whatever you submit and trash you. Like that's a part of the process. Just accept it and move forward in a positive way.
Thank you so much. I really like the point of find your people, find your friends. We have a audience question. Lauren, if you want to unmute and ask your question.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to all the panelists for being here. My name is Lauren. I'm a second year fellow in neonatology at UCSF. I was just wondering if you could speak about sort of transition points in your career pathway, particularly around changing institutions and changing roles, like in your first fellow to faculty transition, and what things that strategies that were specifically helpful in keeping your research moving forward through those points.
Okay, I'll take a stab at it. One thing that I did really look at carefully when I came here to Pittsburgh, and which ended up being helpful, somebody else mentioned, I think it was Carissa, about having internal funding. And that's another kind of variable that I think you'll find are very different across different institutions. And another one that doesn't totally track with prestigiousness. I think everybody, I don't really know what prestigiousness is, But it was, we sort of recognized the concept. And, you know, just there are a lot of places that I think have limited internal funding, or maybe they have great internal funding, but it's just, it's really the ratio of how many people are applying for it, right? And so availability of those funds makes a huge difference. And when I came here, you know, I had a K-08, I was working on my R1, but I needed to hire people and sort of get the lab running. And those like $25,000, $50,000 awards for a year or two just made a huge difference. So I would look for those and persistently apply to a lot of them, because your institution also has a real, they have a vested interest in supporting you too. So it can be a good early mechanism.
Yeah, I can likewise highlight a couple of my transition points. I stayed fellowship to faculty. I stayed at the same institution just because I loved the pathway I was on. So it's unique to my, that position. So I didn't look outside of that for that transition. I got an internal award as a fellow that helped me set up, just like Tom was saying, just kind of seed funding that gave me sort of pilot data for my K-08, which, so that was my transition into fellowship. I did actually have this sort of natural gap where I was actually waiting on a different study to finish accruing some patients so that I could have a biorepository available to do my K-08 on. And so my institution was graciously patient with me, gave me kind of an instructor year and said, you're fine, just keep chugging along. So I don't know that every place would do that. So I'm just really grateful that they kind of gave me a buffer year basically as an actual faculty member before I got my K. And then my other major transition, sorry, this gets a little bit sad for a second, but then there's hope at the end. My K-08 primary research mentor, so I completely agree with Carissa, multiple research mentors, multiple mentors in all kinds of directions, but my primary virology lab research mentor towards the end of my K award unexpectedly passed away. And so he was going to be kind of a pivotal role in helping me launch, right? Yeah, you go to independence, but he was still going to be kind of a voice as I made that transition. And I lost that voice quite suddenly. And so my transition into from K-08 into R01 level funding, the hopefulness, the joy that comes out of it is that he was such a fantastic mentor that he trained me well, and I was still surrounded by a very rich environment. So it wasn't him out on a limb by himself. It was just a whole department, whole institution of people that I still had to ask for help and turn to. And so I was able to make that transition into independent funding. Again, same institution, but it was a very unexpected way to have to transition. But there was help when I needed it, right? There were available people. My institution looked at me and said, we have been investing in you for years. We're not going to walk out on you now. And they really did kind of help me, you know, get established in that sense. And it's, yeah, that's it.
I'll just make maybe another point. I think, you know, there's, looking back, like, are there things I wish I would have done a little bit differently? I also knew that I wanted to stay at my institution because I was in this great mentor relationship. There were family reasons to stay. But I think the fact that I was in, the way Stanford works is you're an instructor and then you have to compete for your position as part of a national search. And I think I would have been better off in some ways if I had still looked for at positions at other institutions. Because when I look back at that early negotiation, I didn't even know what to ask for. Like, I didn't even know like what was possible. I didn't even know what was reasonable. And I was just in this mindset, like, I'll be so thankful if they keep me, that I also don't think I really understood my value. And I, not to say you want to string other institutions along, like, don't go to the end, you know, second and third visits if you know you're not going to move to X, Y, or Z. But I do think when you're getting ready to do that job search, it is helpful, even if you want to stay at your institution, to look at a couple of other institutions that you think could be good fits, because even if you don't end up going there, you make connections, you learn how different institutions support their faculty, and it's really, really, really helpful. And I put in the chat as a direct message to Jingxing, if this webinar type series
works really well thinking about job search, negotiation, startups, because people don't talk about it. But what you want to hear is like people just a few years ahead of you who just did it, like what to ask for, what's possible, what can you get, what's really needed to support you.
Yeah, I would just add that I would be very careful with the contract. Not everything is what it seems like on paper. And so, protected time, look at that very carefully. How are they defining it? Like, what are other people that are, signing on getting? Because clinical time, your clinical duties can take up quite a bit of time. I know personally, to get sort of established, with publications and things like that, I focused earlier on in my faculty role on publications, because those, if you invest the time, that if you're, get off from clinic or you get off from service and it's 9 p.m. and you're working on something, the publications are more likely to get accepted. Sometimes the grants, you just don't have that flexibility. And so just be careful how the contract is written in terms of protected time.
Yeah, thank you. That's an amazing point that I hadn't thought about, is, sort of figuring out what kind of institutional support there is and, how to ask for it. So I guess along those lines, I think especially for graduating fellows, in their first faculty job, who don't necessarily have a K, kind of how do you even navigate that? How do you ask for more protected time when the institution's kind of going, what are you bringing to the table? Or how do you identify what, we are bringing to the table in a way that doesn't have like a dollar amount associated with it?
I think it's tough. I mean, I think that, and maybe others have been, their experience has been different. I actually, that's kind of why I made the point that I did. I did a lot of work and those, late nights, weekends, and I know that's not the ideal. And I'm not saying that anybody should do that. But how they define your time, especially if you're a very clinical heavy program, but you know that you want to continue to pursue, your research. And that's why I think sometimes if you're in an institution where there is internal funding, and there is an internal, not just dollar amount to support the research, but if you are able to negotiate with your division or your department some true protected time, written in, like you're not in clinic on those particular, some X percentage of your time, then I think you can really make headway. Because what I think people, I'm not saying everybody forgets this, but I think it's worth noting that the skills that you're developing as a researcher, just like you develop skills clinically, it takes time. You're going to learn new techniques, whether it's in the basic science space or, clinical research space or, new analyses, different things that you're learning. It takes time. And then you're going to present that data. You want to analyze the data. You want to present that data. You want to use that data to develop, your further grants and your further projects. So it takes quite a bit of time. So I think if there is internal funding where they're able to, if you don't have external funding, and they have internal funding opportunities that actually come with time protection, I think that's even better.
Any other piece of advice or kind of concrete ways that you've navigated that barrier?
I think if you're in the position where you're actually looking for jobs, I think it's really, there is going to be, when you're starting out, you're going to need institutional support. Like, I mean, that's just the case, right? Your protected time, the only way to get protected time, right, is to have somebody basically covering that protected part of your salary, so you're not having to make up for all that time yourself. So if you're in an institution where you're there and you're not thinking of leaving, I think that's one set of obstacles where I do think then you have to make it win-win, and you have to establish some, okay, give me protected time for, let's say, 3 years, and this is what I want to achieve in those 3 years, and then do it. Like, don't promise to do things that you can't deliver. And there's certain things like grants, you have very little control over whether you'll get a grant funded. You do have control over whether you'll submit a grant. You will have control over whether you will submit the manuscript by a certain time, right? So I think in a situation where you feel you don't have a lot of leverage, maybe that's some sort of helpful strategy. If you're looking at other institutions, you need to find out how the division chief and the department chair supports people like you. Because there are varying degrees of what an institution will do. Number one, based on the priorities and how important the mission is. And also just based on the finances of that institution, there's lots of places where it's maybe a really important part of the mission, but they just don't have the money to do it. And you just need to go into those things realistically, right? And make the best decision for yourself, balancing all of these different things.
I see if we have 4 minutes left. Dr. James or Dr. Hooven, any last minute thoughts on kind of, navigating the negotiation process in brief? I feel like we could have an hour probably devoted to that alone.
It's obviously easier if you've got a grant in hand. So if you have your K08 or K23, there's your pathway. If you're in a good environment and have a good plan, those are the pay line on those are still, reasonable, so to speak. It's all relative. If you're upfront and kind of on the same page with a particular institution about the reality of your work and the prospects for your work, if you can make a good case for them that you have been productive and that we all know the funding environment now, and that if there's reasonable chance that they see you're going to be putting in the work and putting in the grant applications, whether internal, external, foundations, it's not just NIH. There are places that will kind of partner with you, even though you may not have your KO8 in hand yet. For instance, my story is going on to faculty without my KO8 in hand, and with me specifically saying, I'm not even going to be able to apply for my KO8 until X date in the future. And I had given them enough evidence to believe that I was worth investing in, is I think what happened. So it's not a one size fits all thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think as multiple of you pointed out, that's actually a really helpful way to think about it, is kind of negotiating with a concrete plan towards a goal would be sort of indicative of productivity, kind of in these sort of non-traditional ways, I guess, so to speak. Aside from just saying like, I'll have a grant. So recognizing that there's 2 minutes left before the next hour, just wanted to spend some time thanking again all of our panelists for joining us and for sharing all of your stories. It's been incredibly inspirational and super, super helpful, sort of all the very concrete points and advice that all of you've been able to provide. And I just, want to also thank the audience for your participation and for your enthusiasm. And again, if you're interested in attending more webinars, we'll definitely be broadcasting them, through sort of our Twitter channels or email lists. If you're interested in additional programming, check out Society for Pediatric Research. We have a number of them, including a Journeys program for some near-peer mentoring, as well as from some senior faculty mentoring, a grant writing program, and a couple other things that are in the pipeline. We're establishing a mentored review program where essentially we'll have residents and fellows be reviewers and be paired with a senior investigator and kind of learn how the review process works. So stay tuned, and you can always reach out to me by email, or I think our emails are on the Society for Pediatric Research website as well. And I'll quickly chop in the chat.
And I just want to add, no matter what the hurdles, no matter what the hills, if you're persistent, this is what you want to do. You should do it, and you will find a way. So don't let anybody be deterred in their path to be clinician scientists.
Thank you for the inspirational.
Great final last words, actually. It's an awesome job, actually. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody. This was great.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks all.